So in order to work, biology needs energy, and that energy has to come from somewhere, and biological energy almost entirely comes from the sun, and it's absorbed by a process called photosynthesis by green plants. They make high energy compounds. We eat those compounds in the form of carbohydrates and sugars and fats, and then we break them down and take the energy in there and convert it into something that you want me to talk about in a moment called proton motive force, which I'll explain. So this process is rather like burning, and in fact that's what it is. It's burning in our bodies in a controlled manner. And that burning, or oxidation, as it's called in chemistry, consumes oxygen. In fact, it consumes almost the oxygen that we breathe in, and it breaks down the high-energy compounds and stores the energy in the form of potential energy, rather like collecting water in a dam that can then be used. The water has energy. It can be released through turbines, and those turbines generate electricity. So it's something rather similar that happens in the mitochondria. So the mitochondria are the powerhouses, the power stations, where these, say, energy-converting events take place. So we're converting energy in food into energy in another form, and that is known as the proton motive force. This concept was developed by a Nobel laureate, an Englishman called Peter Mitchell, and the idea is very simple, that the oxidation, the burning of sugars and fats, leads to the transfer of hydrogen ions. Those are charged hydrogen atoms that have lost their single electron. They're called hydrogen ions. They have a positive charge, and the burning of sugars and fats leads to them being pumped out of the mitochondrion to the outside. And when you do that, you've moved a charge, and what you've done is to generate voltage. So effectively what we've done is to convert the energy in sugars, in carbohydrates and fats, into a voltage. And then that voltage can be used to drive a machine. And that's what happens, because in the inner membranes of mitochondria, there's a machine that I've studied. It's called the ATP synthase. What it then does is to generate a molecule called ATP, or adenosine triphosphate. And this is the energy currency of biology. So the energy in sugars and foods is turned into a voltage. The voltage is then used to do a piece of chemistry to generate the molecule ATP. And the ATP is the energy package that's delivered to the cell and is associated with all kinds of processes in biology. Without ATP, we couldn't do anything. Without the ATP synthase, the machine, we wouldn't exist. The mitochondria have two membranes, one inside the other, and the ATP synthesizing machine that's driven by the voltage is embedded in the inner membrane. And the astonishing thing about it is it has a rotary mechanism, and so the voltage is used to drive a rotor, and the turning of the rotor then carries out chemistry in another part of the machine. And this chemistry is a formation of ATP. And when we first described this idea, it was novel in terms of having an enzyme, that is to say a catalyst, a biological catalyst, that had a rotary action. So from 1974, when I arrived in Cambridge onwards, I was working alongside Frederick Sanger, and he was a Nobel laureate in chemistry some 20 years earlier. And he was at that time developing methods for determining the sequence of DNA. And this method was used eventually in the late 1990s to sequence the human genome. So the first one was in a small virus from a bacterium. And then he decided to sequence the DNA that's found inside mitochondria. I've not mentioned that, but most of the DNA in the cell is in the nucleus, but there's a tiny little bit that's in the mitochondrion. And it has interesting properties, because unlike the DNA in the nucleus, which is a mixture of DNA from both parents, the DNA in the mitochondrion comes exclusively from the mother. But anyway, he wanted to sequence the DNA in human mitochondria. And so I helped by making the human mitochondria from placentas that I got from the maternity home here in Cambridge. And again, my task was to try and contribute to understanding the content, what the genome, the mitochondrial genome, meant. And this got me interested in the respiratory enzymes, because some of the genes that are found in the mitochondria are genes for components of the respiratory enzymes, the enzymes that are converting the energy in foodstuffs and burning those compounds by consuming oxygen. Those are the respiratory enzymes, and they generate the proton motive force, this voltage across the inner membrane. And so I became interested in these enzymes, and I read extensively about them and became most interested in the enzyme that makes ATP. And so about 1980 or thereabouts, I decided to start studying it. And at that time, it was rather a daunting task. It seemed it was clearly a large structure. It was bound in the membrane, which has associated difficulties, and it was clearly complicated. And some people were discouraging. They said that I was unlikely to make progress. I should find something simpler, but I decided to persist, and eventually it all came good in the early 1990s, when we began to see now where all the atoms were, and we began to understand for the first time how this machine worked. And it was from this analysis that the idea of a rotary enzyme came. Up to 1997, it had taken 17 years, and I'd had working with me throughout that period about 10 other people, and we were all working on this particular topic for most of the time. I did one or two other things along the way, but that was mostly what we were doing. And so it really was a huge effort to get to that particular point. The story's still not ending. I'm still working on it, and there are still features that I don't understand, and we've recently made a lot of progress towards getting a more complete understanding. But the story's not over yet. So in October 1997, it was announced that I was to share the Nobel Prize in Chemistry with Paul Boyer and Jens Sku. We'd all worked on ATPases in different ways, and so there was a link between our achievements, and the Nobel Committee in Chemistry decided to recognize what we had done. Really, it was one of the high points in my life, and was really just so wonderful to feel so appreciated and to belong to this very exclusive band of scientists. And I felt really quite humbled by it. And then, of course, once the prize is announced, then you get taken up by the events. Of course, people are thrilled. They want to interview you, talk to you. And then, of course, on December 10th comes the award ceremony in Stockholm, which is an absolutely stupendous affair, and with lots of banquets and parties, as well as the award ceremony itself. And then that's followed by, of course, what seemed like endless invitations to give lectures in Scandinavia, in Europe, and around the world. So I would say for at least a year, my life was not my own, really. I was running around all over the place. But it was a a unique experience. I certainly enjoyed it, and I tried to make the most of it. And actually to pay something back, because I felt that that was one of the things I wanted to do. I'd had, as it were, a pretty easy ride up to getting the Nobel Prize, insofar as I'd not really done much at administration, and I had been in a somewhat privileged position in being able to pursue research for most of my time, and I felt that becoming director and building up this unit was a way of paying back to the Medical Research Council and to the wider scientific community. Well, when I got the Nobel Prize, in some respect, I was unsatisfied personally, because I knew there was much more that could be done to get a deeper understanding. So although we, at that time, understood the effects of rotation, actually we didn't properly understand how rotation was generated. And so that's what I've concentrated on. And we are actually very close now to getting a proper molecular description of that process, so how the voltage drives the rotor and exactly what is being driven. So we didn't know the structure of that parts of the motor, and we're very close to that now. It's been technically extremely difficult thing to do. But along the way, something else has happened, and that is, it turns out that something that was completely unforeseen is that there is associated with the ATP synthase complex in mitochondria, there is another activity, which actually is a general mechanism of regulating it, I think. And so in the mitochondria, the machines are not found singly, but they're found two together. There's two stuck together. And in the middle of contact, there is a channel. And this channel, if it's opened, causes the contents, the mitochondria, to rush out, and then water rushes in. And what happens then is that the mitochondria swell and they explode. And this leads to the death of the cell. There are two mechanisms of cell death, and they both involve the mitochondria. On the one hand, there's apoptosis, which is programmed cell death. And on the other hand, there's necrosis. And what I've just described is the process of necrosis. And we're trying to understand this mechanism and how exactly what the channel is in structural terms, and how it opens, and how to stimulate its opening with drugs, and also how to prevent its opening with drugs, because that would have a big effect in a number of areas of medicine. So this is something that's just happened in the last couple of years. We've made tremendous progress. When you came through the door, I was actually writing the paper, because we want to communicate this as soon as possible. So I'm very excited about this.